It's a pleasure to have Sherry Gleed here this morning. Sherry has been a collaborator and friend for many years. She's chairman of the Department of Health Policy and Management at the School of Public Health here at Columbia, and has been a close collaborator in the outcome study that about this program that we're now trying to publish. She's also a distinguished economist, I guess primarily she's a distinguished economist. She does some of the things with us as pro bono activity. She's a distinguished economist. One of her studies won the Eugene Garfield Prize of Research America for bringing economics and medical research together and showing the value of medical research. She's won a number of other awards and I believe has been nominated for the position as an Assistant Secretary of Health in the Obama administration. I hope
you may hear about it this afternoon, maybe.
So I hope we're not about to lose her to Washington, at least permanently. But she's here today, and that's what's important. Sherry, it's a delight to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you. So as that introduction I hope made clear, I'm an economist, which some economists believe that economics is a science, and I'm not persuaded. So it's not clear that I should be addressing a room full of science teachers. But what I want to talk about today is how economics and policy intersect with thinking about science in a very particular case. And this is the case of hospital-acquired infections, which is a very interesting problem. I don't know how many of you saw the New York Times this morning. You woke up that early? If you see it, there was actually an op-ed in Today's Times by Paul O'Neill about how we should save money in the healthcare system by wiping out hospital-acquired infection. So this is a very hot policy topic, and it's of great economic importance, but it also shows how economics and policy interact with science. So I thought it might be an interesting case to go through with you and to tell you a little bit about the research that we're doing in this area. I should preface my remarks by saying we don't actually have an answer to the questions I'm going to pose to you yet today, but I want to just give you an illustration of this project and how we're going about it. So here's what I want to talk about today, a bunch of different things that all touch on different aspects of policy. So we'll talk a little bit about healthcare-associated infections, talk about the economic problem that makes this of interest to economists, talk about modeling the cost of healthcare-associated and acquired infections and what the tricks of that would be and why understanding the science of how these infections happen and spread can really affect thinking about policy, talk about a change in Medicare payment policy, and then finally, because it's also of policy interest and potentially of interest, I think, to you, one of the real innovations, especially that the Obama administration is pushing, is to increase the use of electronic medical records, electronic hospital records. And we health services researcher types are very excited about this because electronic medical records are potentially a great source of data. We may be able to learn a lot about what works and what doesn't work using electronic medical records. It turns out that this hospital has developed an electronic medical record, and this research project is one of the very first being done that's really making very extensive use of that electronic medical record. So I want to talk a little bit about that and a little bit about kind of the data options that are available. Now, all of this research is actually funded under a grant from the NIH that's looking at the distribution of the cost associated with antimicrobial resistance and assessing how policies that change incentives could spur the adoption of effective interventions. So this is a research project, and one of the nice things about being an economist working in a school of public health, as I do, rather than in an economics department, is that I get to work with a lot of people who know a lot more than I do about many things that I, you know, flunked out of in the 10th grade. So we have epidemiologists and statisticians and hospital informatics people working on this project, as well as a couple of economists. So just to put this in context, the CDC and others have estimate each year, should I be not moving around so much? All right. Estimate each year the number of infections people get associated with hospitals, so healthcare-associated infections. And in intensive care units each year, 394,000 infections in outside of intensive care units, over a million infections, about 1.7 million people a year get an infection in the hospital or in a healthcare setting. That's a pretty terrible number, right? This is a real problem because, especially if we think about healthcare and you think about how healthcare works and you think about yourself, have any of you ever had to have surgery or a procedure in a hospital? Yes? Okay, so when you're thinking about picking a hospital, you think about where's a good doctor, where's a good surgeon, right? But nobody ever really thinks about the possibility that after you have your surgery, you could get an infection, and that could be pretty bad. So these numbers are really cause for some alarm, both in terms of the human impact and actually also because of the cost impact. The CDC estimates that hospital-acquired infections by themselves cost about $5 billion in extra treatment costs and so forth in 2000. And we're associated with 99,000 deaths in a year. So there are a lot of people who die because of these infections. Now, we have to be really careful thinking about that. Can you think of why? Who do you think dies of these infections?
People who have complications, they came in with other complications.
Right, so typically most of those 99,000 deaths will be of people who had a lot of risk factors, were pretty sick already, and maybe what we did is really hasten their death, which doesn't mean that it didn't happen. It's still a bad thing. There are, of course, some people who wouldn't have died at all from this condition if it hadn't been for the infection. So thinking about the magnitude of that number is a little complicated because you want to think about the severity of the people who are going to be affected by it. And actually, none of the work that's been done in this area has looked at that question, has actually asked the question, if these people had not died of hospital-acquired infection, what was their life expectancy? Which would seem like an important question that we might still want to answer. So fundamentally, there are substantial costs associated with hospital-acquired infections. Now, the thing that we're looking at particularly is the cost at the infection level. The General Accountability Office of the federal government estimates that each infection costs on average about $8,500, which is a lot of money. And in a literature review that we just finished completing, it's about $9,500, about a 24% difference over the cost of the hospitalization without the infection. So this is a pretty big number. Now, all of this would be of no economic interest whatsoever. It would only be of interest to people who do science if it were not for the fact that we actually know that there are things that can be done about it. So if there was nothing we could do about it, it would be important, but it would not be a policy problem, because policy can only do something if there's a tool at hand. The interesting thing here is there are interventions. It is possible to get the rate of infections down, way down, much lower than they are now. So there are, and some of them are pretty straightforward. Does anyone know what the most effective intervention is?
Washing your hands.
Washing your hands very, very often and properly. And that turns out not to be done as much as it ought to be. Everybody believes that they wash their hands all the time, but in fact they don't. And so there are all kinds of interesting interventions that try and get people to wash their hands. That might be an interesting science project too, because if you map what the bacteria on people's hands are, it looks pretty ugly. Mm-hmm. So what are the costs and benefits? When we think about an intervention, you think, are we going to do this? It depends on whether it's worth it, and it depends on what it's going to cost to do it. What are the benefits and what are the costs? So what are the benefits of actually taking these steps to avoid healthcare-associated infections? Better patient outcomes. People are not going to die or not going to die as quickly. Lower healthcare costs. Fewer readmissions. So people won't be readmitted to the hospital. It turns out these infections may take a while until they take their toll, and so people are discharged to nursing homes, develop infections there, come back, and so on. And these are actually two problems that are of particular interest to economists. The fact that infections spread, especially resistant infections, from one patient to another. So if an infection becomes resistant to antibiotics and that spreads to other patients, the cost of treating those other patients and the prospects for those patients will also get worse. So worrying about the spread, particularly of resistant infections to other patients. And then this actually is a particularly interesting problem, one I'm not going to talk about very much today, but that makes this a particularly acute problem, is that if antibiotics are used improperly, resistance will develop, which we call in economics an externality. So that those antibiotics will no longer be as effective in dealing with other people who have not even gotten sick yet, people who may not even exist yet. Future generations. So trying to think about how we reduce the spread of resistance to future susceptibles is another reason, a motivation for working on this project. Now, all of that is the benefit to doing something about it. What's the cost? Well, the cost is people have to spend time washing their hands and doing the other things. We have to implement these protocols. It turns out you can't just say it to people. Saying things to people, as you all know very well, doesn't really work. So just telling them doesn't do it. You actually have to monitor whether they're doing it, whether they're doing it right. You have to watch over it. You have to invest resources into it. This is not a trivial matter to just say, you know, everyone should wash their hands and we should get rid of infections. We've known that for 100 years and it hasn't happened. Now, from an economic perspective, we can think about what is the optimal level of infection management effort. So think about a hospital that's trying to decide how much effort it should exert to manage infections. We can think of this line as describing the marginal private benefit, the benefit to the hospital of reducing infections. So what is the benefit to the hospital? Their staff don't have to deal with infected patients. Maybe they get a better reputation, although none of you were even aware that there were those huge numbers and you weren't looking at the infection rates in hospitals before you checked in. But maybe it would help the hospital in a bunch of different ways. On the other hand, the more infection management you do, the more costly it's going to be. So if we compare the cost to the benefits, this hospital is likely to invest in an infection management effort at level X. They're going to do that much infection management, right? Now, is that the right level of infection management? How do we know? Well, what is the right level of infection management? What is the right number of infections to have in a hospital? Now, Paul O'Neill this morning said there should never be any infections in any hospital. And I would say, as an economist, that cannot possibly be the right answer. All right? Now, why should that not be the right answer?
Because it's going to happen. Cost too much money.
It's going to cost so much money to get that level of infections to absolute zero. I mean, zero is a really low number. What are we going to do with all the visitors who come in to see people? Right? All the potential ways that somebody could get infected. We can't make this number zero. We have to pick what is the most cost-effective level. I actually want to just, so you can sort of ring a bell with the health policy discussions that are going on right now. Right now, one of the other issues that's happening in healthcare reform is a question called comparative effectiveness research. Have you heard at all about this question? The government is now going to put some money into comparing the benefits of alternative medical treatments for the same condition. So, you know, is it better to have bypass surgery or is it better to have an angioplasty if you have a heart attack? And they're going to do studies comparing medical treatments. This has turned out to be a very controversial thing. You wouldn't think it would be controversial, but you never know in policy what will turn out to be controversial. This turns out to be very controversial. People are concerned that if the government does this kind of analysis, they will start to say that some treatments are too expensive. They're not worth it. And they're using something called cost-effectiveness criteria. So we economists think of cost-effectiveness all the time, but people in the policy world are understandably anxious about the idea that there would be some amount of effort that wasn't worth expending. Paul O'Neill this morning would have found it reprehensible for me to say there is a cost-effective level of infections that's not zero. Right? Can you see that? That would be, right? But cost-effectiveness says we want to balance the costs and benefits and try and figure out what the right way to go is. So we're going to think about a cost-effectiveness criterion standard for thinking about how much infection management the hospital should do. And we're going to use that for figuring out what standards, what penalties, what subsidies we might want to set. Now, I'm doing all this work in my capacity as a researcher, not as a policymaker. I'm just trying to give this information to policymakers. I don't know what the government is actually going to do. Nothing I say should be interpreted in any way as the view of anybody except possibly myself. So we could think of cost-effectiveness criterion for setting those standards, but another question that I think is even more interesting, suppose you were managing a hospital. Where should you focus your effort? So remember that earlier slide? Mm-hmm. Here? Should you put all of your infection containment effort in the ICU, or should you spread it outside of the ICU? What do you think the right answer is? The answer is we don't know. Okay? We have to know how much does it cost to reduce infections in the ICU? What's the benefit of reducing infections in the ICU? How much does it cost outside of the ICU? And what's the benefit there? And we don't know. So a reasonable question that a hospital might ask is, I can't do everything at once. Where should I focus my efforts? And my research should help to illuminate the answer to that question. So where were we? Here. So Just to give you a sense of what cost effectiveness is about, cost effectiveness, as economists measure it, is a ratio that looks at how much additional cost we incur to gain an additional increment of outcome. So how much does it cost my hospital to reduce infections by one infection a year? Okay. If it costs less than the benefit, what should I do? So I'm going to put in a protocol that will reduce infections by one. Should I do that? Yes or no? It depends. Okay, it depends. What does it depend on? How much does it cost to reduce infections by one? Do you see that? Now, I'll tell you a little bit of economics. I know I'm not supposed to be teaching you economics, but just so that you know, it's always cheap to get rid of the first infection. So if I go into this hospital, no one's done any infection control, I can come up with a really easy, cheapo way to get rid of the first infection. Do you see why? That's the low-hanging fruit, right? That's the person who, you know, I don't know what it is. There is no Purell bottle in the room. If we just put the Purell bottle in the room, we could get rid of an infection. But it's really expensive to get rid of the last infection. Do you see that? So I put the Purell bottles in every room. I've changed the disposables. I've done everything. I've gotten my infections down to just one a year. Getting rid of that last one, that's going to be really expensive. Okay, so we're asking, given where we are today, what's the additional cost from where we are to get rid of one in more infection? And that's how we think about cost effectiveness. We think about that ratio. So are we achieving the cost effective level of infections? Now, here I have to confess that there's actually existing literature on this, and the answer is no. Okay? The answer is there's lots of benefits to people of getting rid of infections, and hospitals know how to do it, and they don't do it. Okay? There are many things they could do. They know how to do it, and they don't do it.
Why?
That's the question. Good question. So the one reason, it costs them. Yeah, it's all right, but I'm saying it's cost effective. It's worth it. They do all kinds of things here that cost them. Why don't they do this? Well, you're getting close. You're getting close, okay? So here's the thing from an economist's point of view. This is the question of the difference between cost effectiveness if you're the manager, the fiscal manager of the hospital, or cost effectiveness if you're society at large. So imagine that we had some person who was thinking about the whole society and everybody's well-being. That person would pick something. That person is different from the hospital CEO. Because what's the hospital CEO thinking about?
Money.
The hospital CEO is thinking about the benefits and costs to the hospital, not the benefits and costs to future generations and the benefits and costs to people who aren't in the hospital or won't ever come there. He or she is just thinking about the hospital. So there is a potential mismatch between who incurs the cost and who benefits from it. And that's actually the reason that I got interested in this project in the first place. So if we go back to these, so first of all, who bears all the costs of implementing infection control?
Medicare.
The hospital. The hospital. They have to pay the staff. They have to buy the disposables. They have to do all that stuff, right? They have to get the management to pay attention to this problem and not another problem, right? So you know about this because you all work in institutions. You can't do everything at once. So the management of the hospital has to choose this problem. That's all costly to the hospital. But who gets the benefits? So let's see who gets the benefits. Better patient outcomes. Who benefits from being healthier? The hospital?
The patient.
The patient. Okay? Who benefits from lower healthcare utilization and system-wide costs? The patient does because they pay less out of pocket. Who else? Society, who else? Maybe the hospital, maybe the payer, the insurance company, maybe the hospital, maybe the patient. Who benefits from fewer readmissions? The patient and the payer. Does the hospital benefit from fewer readmissions? No, readmissions are customers to a hospital, right? It's a horrible thing to say, but it's true. Unless there's reputation involved, right? And we just... Since you didn't even know about this, we know that there's no reputation. What about less spread to other patients? We don't even know who they are.
But we care about them.
We care about them, but they aren't part of this game. Do you see that? They can't influence the process because all of you are potential winners if we reduce hospital infections. But, you know, everybody will, you know, good luck willing, you're not going to need to know about that. You're not going to be the specific one who's going to need it, right? So you have no way to...
Wouldn't those other patients then pay more, technically, as customers to the hospital?
Yeah, but they don't know which one, which hospital. They don't even know who they are. You don't know if you're ever going to need this hospital, right?
Is there a correlation between high infections and high absenteeism in hospitals?
Within the hospital?
Yeah.
It's the patients who are getting these illnesses. It's not really the staff. So most of it is not. And future people, like, forget them. Now, we don't even know. They're not even born yet. So they're not influencing this process. Right? So we have this big mismatch between who gains and who loses. Right? So we could think about this. Remember I showed you that the marginal private benefit and the marginal cost got you to X? Right? But actually, there's a lot more benefit, marginal social benefit, we call it. And if we actually were making decisions around the marginal social benefit, we wouldn't choose a level of infection management that's called X. We would choose the infection management level called Y. Do you see that? Okay, so that's what the big problem is. And so this is a very famous report of the Institute of Medicine. The Institute of Medicine has been looking really hard at the quality of healthcare in the U.S. healthcare system, and they published a very important report called Crossing the Quality Chasm. It's got like real nice alliteration and everything, so everyone remembers the name. And they say, despite the evidence that poor quality costs money, however, healthcare organizations and professionals have not adopted quality-based process management to compete in today's marketplace. They don't care. Indeed, a variety of barriers embodied in current payment methods prevent healthcare organizations from pursuing quality improvement. Right? That it actually might actually stand in the way of a hospital wanting to improve quality the way that the payment system works today. So how does the payment system work today? Well, private insurance companies, until quite recently and even continually now in most places, paid hospitals per day that their patient was in the hospital. So if your patient is in the hospital today, you get a payment. Tomorrow, you get a payment. The next day, you get a payment. Infected patients spend more time in the hospital. So the costs of spending that extra time in the hospital don't get absorbed by the hospital. They get passed along to the payer. Or under certain scenarios, which we'll talk about. Do you see that? So if what happens is an infected patient just stays in the hospital an extra 5 days, the payer pays for an extra 5 days. The hospital might actually benefit. Can you see how the hospital might actually be better off? Depending on how much it costs for each of those days to treat the patient, it might actually not be so bad. Medicare and many other private insurers don't pay that way. They pay using something called diagnosis-related groups. It's kind of an interesting concept. You can think about the parallel for education. So what they do is they pay. So this one is like you pay for each day that the kid is in school or something. And then you might think you don't really want to teach them that well because then they'll have to stay in extra days and you'll get paid. But you won't get any summer vacation. This one says you get a fixed payment per student, all right? And it depends on the admitting diagnosis. So, you know, if they're a troubled student, you get more money. Wouldn't that be nice? All right, so you get a fixed cost per admitting diagnosis. That means in every patient that shows up at this hospital with a heart attack, this hospital gets a fixed amount of money to treat that patient, whether the patient is here for 2 months or 3 days. Okay? So the burden is on the hospital to try and keep the costs low. But there's something called major complicating condition. So if that patient comes in with a heart attack but also has diabetes, the hospital gets extra money. Okay? And it turns out that healthcare-acquired infections constitute a major complicating condition. All right? So in this payment system, if somebody gets one of these infections, the costs get passed along to Medicare, or at least in theory. Do you see the problem? Okay. So in 2008, Medicare got wise. And they said, no more. We've had enough of this. If bad things happen to patients in the hospital, like you amputate the wrong leg or what are called never events, if these bad things happen, you don't get any more payment. Okay. So they added 8 conditions. There are 7 more conditions here. All right. So we're going to add conditions. If bad things happen to people, you're not going to get any more payment. And I think I gave you a reading that actually talks about that policy. So just to give you an illustration of some of the kinds of the way that this system works, suppose somebody comes in and has with a stroke. a stroke without a complicating condition. They didn't have any problem. The payment average is $5,347. The hospital gets that much money to care for this patient who had a stroke. Now, suppose somebody comes in with a stroke and has a complicated condition, like in addition to having the stroke, they fell down. Then the hospital gets $6,177.
Outside of the hospital.
They fell down outside of the hospital. And now suppose they get a stroke and they develop a stage 3 pressure ulcer, which is something that you get if they don't turn you over or they don't take care of you as well as they might in the hospital. So that's a hospital-acquired condition, a bad hospital-acquired condition. Then you get $8,030 under the old payment system, but now they're only going to give you the $5,347. Yes?
So this is the reason why I used to work in a hospital. So this is the reason why the billing person would put like 3, 4, 5 different codes.
Yes. Oh, you're way ahead of me. Okay, so just hang on. You just hang on, okay? You're there. You're there. Where am I going to talk about that? Make sure I've got it in here. Yeah, I've got it. All right, well, just hold on to that idea because we'll come back to it.
Okay.
All right, so what's the potential impact? Well, in this hospital, so I should have not shown you this number. Did you all see it already? In this hospital, this wonderful hospital that we work in, 12% of admissions got a hospital-acquired infection. That's a high number. Now, it's not a high number nationally, but that's a pretty big number. More than 1 in 10 patients who comes into the hospital winds up with some sort of infection. Yeah.
Why is the rate of UTI so high?
Catheters.
Oh.
Catheters.
And is this the
case? So basically, you get one of these infections because something in your body is very good at fighting off infections, as you know. But if we break the shields that normally prevent things from coming into your body, that's when infections occur. So what we really see, I'll show those to you in a little while, infections occur when people have surgery because then there are infections that can happen at the surgical site. They happen when people are on ventilators for pneumonia because stuff gets into you by non-normal routes. They get it through catheters. So anytime something enters your system, it's bad news, okay? So basically the idea here is if we reduce the marginal cost, if we change the way that the hospital looks at the problem, maybe we can get them acting in their own private interest to get to Y. That's the sort of logic here. Okay, so now our project. We are trying to study some aspects of this problem, not the whole thing, in a study that we're doing here at New York Presbyterian Hospital. New York Presbyterian Hospital has some really nice features from this perspective. One is that it has two main campuses, the one here and the one down at Cornell on the Upper East Side. Do you know where that hospital is?
60th Street.
60th Street. So those of you who know New York City, how many of you work in Manhattan or live in Manhattan? Okay, so what's the difference between here and there? Okay, so this is a very different population up here than it is down there. All right, so that's good because we want to see some variation in our data. Another nice thing about it is that the cultures of the two campuses are actually different. This is a relatively recent merger. The hospitals work in somewhat different ways. So we're going to be able to, we hope, extract some information from that. This hospital also has something called the Allen Pavilion, which is a community hospital located north of here that doesn't deal with such sick patients and operates more like a community hospital. So there again, maybe we can get some more information. And there's the Children's Hospital here. So we're using all of this. And we're doing this by studying in great detail the hospital's electronic medical record system. Now, when you say to people, and they talk about it on television, hospitals and electronic medical record systems, I think everybody thinks about it like, you know, what do we have? You know, your Facebook page or something, right? This beautifully integrated, wonderful thing. But actually, nobody's electronic medical record system yet works that way. Because the way electronic medical record systems developed is that somebody put one in somewhere, and then someone else put one in somewhere else, and then we have all these different systems. So we have a different system for the pathology lab, for the radiology lab, for the pharmacy. All the different parts of the hospital have different existing electronic systems that all interface. There's operating room data. And this all goes into something called the clinical data warehouse. from which we get our data because our project is called CERAR. So this is all the medical information. And then we have added to this cost accounting information. Because what we're trying to understand is, when we see one of these infections, who actually pays for it? And although there's been a lot of speculation about it, like those quotations, no one has actually figured out who actually pays. Who pays under a per diem payment system? Because some of our payers here at the hospital are per diem payers. Who pays under DRG system? What percentage of these things get upcoded because of infections? And who's actually bearing the cost of the infection? Where is the leverage point here? So that's, you know, so we've added to this cost accounting information and something called present on admission data, which I'll talk about in a minute. Okay. So we are using data linkage. We are looking particularly at resistant infections. Do all of you know what resistant infections are? Resistant infections, infections that are resistant to the antibiotics that are typically used to treat them. We're identifying the cases with these resistant infections over this period, and we are matching them to susceptible and non-infected cases. And I'll talk about that in a minute in using something called propensity score matching. And we're collecting data on costs and payments. Okay, so let me just take a minute to talk about propensity score matching, which is a very, very hot topic in medical research right now. And you may even, if you read the Science Times from time to time, you'll see a reference to this idea. One of the problems in using electronic medical record systems or data, existing data to do studies, is that you can't really randomize in those systems. So one of the problems in thinking about healthcare policy and health services research is, for many of the problems that we would really like to know the answers to, randomization is simply not an option. We're not going to randomize people to infections to see what it costs. We're not going to infect some people randomly. That would be pretty gross. But not only do we not have the ability to do that, but if you think about how much data there is out there already, how much information, it almost seems like you would like to be able to get something out of that somehow, even though it's not randomized. So how close can we get to randomization? And a lot of the work that's currently being done in epidemiology, in medical sciences, in economics, in the part that relates to healthcare, is thinking about what you can do with data that are not from randomized experiments. So what can we learn? I'll give you another example. Drugs get out on the market. The FDA tests them in randomized trials, right? How many? But you can't get that many people in a randomized trial. 2,000 people take the medicine. Once it gets out and 1,000,000 people are taking it, stuff starts to happen in the population. Can you learn anything from that population? After all, you haven't randomized people to receiving the medication or not receiving the medication. Do you see that? So are we just going to throw up our arms in despair and say, you know, until we do a big enough randomized trial, we'll never really know whether this medication is good for you or causes side effects? Or is there some way we can look at the data harder to try and think about what's going on? Propensity score matching is a statistical technique among many that tries to get at this question, tries to match more effectively people who are susceptible to infection, people who have infections and people who are not infected, or people who have taken a drug and people who haven't taken a drug. Okay, so can we use the data to see whether we can get some kind of a matching that it's never going to be as good as matching in a clinical trial. So in terms of the precision of the estimate will be lost there, but we will get generalizability that isn't available in a clinical trial. We will be able to look at what actually happens in the world. So we're going to use propensity score matching. For those of you who are interested in statistics and in these methods, I'm happy to send you references, but I'm not going to put any equations on the board. We're going to collect data on costs and payments. And basically, we want to look at several questions that are going to help inform this idea of, do you want to treat the sickest patients first? Do you want to treat the ICU where the risk is very high and the patients are very sick? Do you want to get out there and just work on the floors? Is this payment arrangement thing going to work? Is it going to create some problems? So we're going to ask a question like, do healthcare acquired infections add a fixed cost to the care of a patient? Is a healthcare acquired infection just a cost that we put on top of the bill? Or is it actually shifting the entire cost profile over the patient's stay in the hospital, which is going to change, as I'll show you in a minute, the policy question. And then, are healthcare-acquired infections a real thing? Or are they actually just a measure of underlying disease severity? So is what we're seeing here is that the patients who get these infections are just much sicker than everyone else. And the infection is just one more symptom of the fact that these people are really, really sick. So how can we think about underlying disease severity with respect to healthcare-acquired infections. And why will that matter? I'll talk about that in a minute, too. So just to, because I have a little bit of data to share with you from the project, I feel like I ought to, even though I'm not going to talk about it anymore except for two slides. This is looking at this hospital at the cost of patients with and without healthcare-acquired infections, just all patients with and without these conditions. We haven't done any matching. Patients with bloodstream infections, the average bill for a patient who has a bloodstream infection in this hospital is $198,000. This is a non-ICU case. Okay. The average bill for a patient with a urinary tract infection, $55,000. These are very big numbers. These are the costs outside the ICU. For ICU patient with a bloodstream infection, the average bill for that patient is over $400,000. It is amazing how quickly you can spend money in a hospital. So these are just really costly, and they're much more costly than the control patients here. But these are not matched, nothing very exciting happening here, just to give you a sense of kind of where these numbers line up. Now, rather than because we've just got our data and it's not ready to show and it's not ready to go out there, I'm going to talk about the stuff that's in the existing literature on this. And we've been looking at all the studies that have already been done. And this is a summary of the studies that have been done on these different kinds of infections. We've adjusted all the dollars in these studies into U.S. dollars and current currency so they are comparable. And this is looking at two things. So just to sort of explain what's going on here, I guess there's a pointer. Is there a pointer on this? Top one. There you go. All right. So the taking a bloodstream infection case, these are looking at the studies that have been done in this area. The average cost of a control episode, so I'll come to that in a second, is $32,000. And then the average difference between the control and the case is an additional $39,000. So the way to read this is, once you've matched the people who look like they might get a bloodstream infection, the people who look like they might get a bloodstream infection but did not do so cost on average $32,000. So do you remember my previous slide where I showed you the bloodstream infections? Those are very expensive cases. Now, why would that be? Because in order to get a bloodstream infection, you're going to need to have a lot of stuff happening with your blood, right? Lots of tubes are going to be coming in and out of you. Those are sick people. They cost a lot, even if they don't get an infection. And then on top of that, the estimated cost is an additional $39,000 for a patient with an infection. All right? If we look at surgical sites, those are actually a little less expensive, and the additional cost is a little smaller. Respiratory, and this is just the studies that don't specify the site. Okay? Now, that's all very well and good, and that's actually where the government is getting all its numbers from, and those CDC reports, the General Accounting Office and everybody, they're looking at numbers like this. Okay? However, if you actually look at the studies and compare across the studies, here's what you see. Let's just take those bloodstream infection cases. In one study, the control episodes cost $3,600. And in another study, they cost as much as $80,000. These are very different kinds of patients. These are very different studies. You know, look at the differences here. It's a $1,000, $122,000.
Is this international?
Most of these are U.S. studies. Most of them are U.S. studies. But they're just really different populations. And if we look at these differences, the additional cost on top of it, they are also quite different. Some of them are actually cheaper. Okay, so there's an enormous amount of variability in the data. Now, as an economist and as a scientist, when you look at something that's out there and has this much variability in it, what I think you should think about is that you don't really understand it. Right? If you really understood what was going on, you wouldn't see numbers that are this variable. You would really be able to be more precise in your estimates. So what is happening here? Oh, I'm about to show you a bunch of numbers. They don't even have to do that. Okay. All right. So the one thing that we talk about in economics, and I think it's kind of a concept that has its analog in science, is to think about the process generating the data. So when you do an experiment of any sort, you get data. But what you really want to be thinking about is, what is the process that could be going on that generated the data that I see? The data don't exist by themselves. They didn't just come out of a random number generator. Well, that would still be a process, right? There has to be some process that's generating my data. And what could the process be? Well, here is one sort of process. All right? This is a low-cost patient, normally would spend 11 days in the hospital and then be discharged. Most patients, the dirty little secret of hospitals is patients are the sickest when they first come in, and they get cheaper and cheaper as they stay in the hospital. Okay, so here's the normal curve, the curve that I just made these numbers up completely, that this happens to this patient as they stay in the hospital over time. And over this period, they spend $16,500 during their 11 days in the hospital. Very cheap. Okay. Now, suppose this patient got an infection on day two. One possible story generating the data is now this patient has an infection, and so we treat the patient exactly the same way, except we give them a dose of antibiotics several times a day. And so they incur an additional $2,000 in costs, but they continue to recover, and they go home on day 11. Do you see that? That's a process. Same thing, they could be a really expensive case, right? But it also takes 4 days of antibiotics to get them well. Now, if this is the story, if these are the kinds of cases, it doesn't really matter where I intervene. I should intervene wherever it's cheapest, because I save $2,000 on every intervention. Do you see that? Every case. But here's another story. In this case, when you get an infection, what happens is you stay in the hospital an extra 4 days. Okay, so you get there's an increase, you get the antibiotics, but also your recovery is delayed 4 days, and so you stay in the hospital longer. So now the relationship is going to be quite different. And same thing here. Okay. So if it's an increment, the whole thing is just going to be up by $2,000. Whatever the control group cost is, the other cost will be $2,000 more. But if it's not an increment, it's going to be a more difficult relationship. Now look back here. Look at this. How is all of this measured? What is it treating it as if? These analyses are implicitly doing what? How are they thinking about the data? Are they thinking about it as if the curve is shifting over or as if it's just an increment? Just an increment. The studies are treating the data as if it's just an increment. Do you see that? They're just, we have the control cost, we add some amount, and that's what it is. They're not thinking about longer stays in the hospital or really any relationship, right? So wait a second, let me go forward again. Another thing I want to show you. So here's the low-cost case. So it's 16,000 and 11,000. In the high-cost case, that relationship is not the same either, right? So they're not thinking about that relationship being a function of what the control cost is. It's just an add-on number. That's probably not the process that's generating the data. It's the process that's generating the policy, but it's not the process that's actually what's happening in the hospital. Okay, so if it's an increment and delay, the relationship will be different. So this is the, in our data from all these studies, the relationship between the case and control group costs. The first thing you see is that the cases cost more when the control groups cost more, and that this is not a very well-specified relationship. Where did I put it? Okay. It also goes through zero. Does that make any sense? What does it mean if it goes through zero? That means that if you have a low enough control group cost, the infection costs nothing. That doesn't make any sense. All right, so we have a real problem with the existing data. We're going to have to try and think about what's going on here. Now, what makes this even more complicated is people don't just get infections by walking into hospitals. Some patients are much more at risk of an infection than others. And what are the things that make you at risk for an infection? Being older, having certain kinds of conditions when you come in, having certain kinds of procedures, and you see all of those involve essentially breaking the barriers, staying in the hospital. So, one of the real phenomena of the recent past in hospitals is people used to stay in the hospital for a long time. Does any of you know how long your mom was in the hospital when you were born?
2 weeks.
7 days. How many of you have had a child in the last 15 years in your family? How long were you in the hospital? 2 days, 4 days, 3 days, 1 day, right? Now, we worry about getting people out of the hospital too soon, but one thing that you should know is staying in the hospital for a long time, really not a good idea, because there's all kinds of icky stuff floating around the hospital, to use a technical term. Long-term use of antimicrobials are also a risk factor for getting infections. So these are not just any old patients who are going to get an infection. Just to make things even more complicated, if we think of a patient with a risk factor as well as a delay, we're going to see all kinds of different relationships showing up in the data, right? Just not to go into this in too much detail. So there's tremendous variation in cost, and we don't understand the underlying cost structure. And so we're going to spend a lot of time with our data trying to figure it out, because what you want to do depends on how the costs come about. If you think it's an incremental cost only, if you think that everybody who gets an infection, it has the same effect on cost, where should you intervene first? Where should you intervene? In the wards or in the ICU? Or what should you do if you're the hospital manager and you think it's this story? What's the sensible thing to do? Intervene wherever the intervention is cheapest. Okay? Whatever the cheapest thing to do is, do that first. Because no matter where you go, you save $2,000. So pick the cheapest thing. Do you see that? On the other hand, if you think it's this story, you're going to save a lot more money if you intervene where the costs are greatest. So if you intervene in the ICU, say. Right? If you stay 4 days in the ICU, that's going to be a lot of savings. So go into the ICU, even if it's a little more costly. Do you see that? So it actually matters where you go. Now, risk factors. Policy could have undesirable effects. If, in fact, the risk factors are the things that are really driving the probability of infection, you could actually lead hospitals to avoid those patients, to do all kinds of other problems. So just to go through this, oh, I'm almost done. All right, I'll talk even faster. Is it possible? So here's the policy issue. Remember I gave you that article, Medicare is going to change the way they pay. If a certain condition was acquired during hospitalization, no more payment. But there's an escape. There are a couple of escape clauses that are important. The first one is this thing called present on admission. Some people can't come in with infections already, right? If you come in with an infection, they're not going to penalize you for that. Does that make sense? Right? Some people come in with an infection. So there's the potential for present on admission. So what are some of the hospital responses? I'm just going to walk through these. One is to do with present on admission coding changes, selection, and financial effects. So present on admission, one of the things that people worry about is what hospitals are now going to start doing is testing everybody as soon as they come in to see if they have an infection. Because if you have an infection when you come in, we can code it as present on admission and save the money. Now, that could be okay. That might be good. But it might also be bad. First of all, we're going to find more infections. It's going to look like the policy has this perverse effect of causing all sorts of people to have infections who didn't have them in the first place because we never tested them because they never got really sick. And we're going to treat lots more people with antibiotics. And is that a good idea?
No,
because then we're going to build up resistance. So this is a potentially perverse consequence of what seems like a good idea, which is the present on admission coding. Again, who are you going to test? Are you going to test the high-risk patients, the low-risk patients, everybody? And this is the same kind of question. You test if the cost of testing is less than the cost of the code change. All right, I'm going to show you that may actually lead you to test the low-risk people, which would be really stupid policy, okay? So here's the next problem. DRG coding depends on, this is the point that somebody made here in the back, primary condition and complicating conditions. So there are 3,000 complicating conditions, including certain healthcare-associated infections. Now, we're going to say, no, healthcare-acquired infections, you can't be coded for. But what you might start doing is coding these other things even more than you already are. So it turns out there is an entire industry, who would have thought, that is in the coding business. They write computer programs to tell nurses and hospital staff what to look for in patients so they can get upcoded. Most patients who have a healthcare-associated infection also have a lot of other codes. So in fact, the policy change probably will have no effect for most patients. Because although they won't get upcoded by the healthcare-acquired infection, they will get upcoded for lots of other things. Now, that's a particular problem in the high-cost cases, because the lower your risk, the less likely you are to have anything else besides a healthcare-acquired infection, right? So this change is going to really push people. It's going to give a good incentive in terms of the low-cost cases, but not where we might really want it, which is the high-cost cases. Do you see how that... This is tricky. Okay. Next problem. Some healthcare-acquired infection risk is predictable. There are conditions that put you at risk of all these things, lots and lots of conditions. I'm particularly interested in this one. Coming from a nursing home actually puts you at a lot of risk of an infection because you're more frail and also there's more infections happening in nursing homes and so on. If you know that those patients are going to be costly and you're not going to be reimbursed for them, the hospital might start taking steps to avoid taking those patients. Okay, now, this is a delicate problem. How do you do this, right? But how you build up your relations with nursing homes, how you work with the ER staff and so on, can affect the kinds of patients that you get. Finally, another problem that you might really worry about is that all the risk factors for infection are particularly predominant in certain kinds of populations, low-income populations and frail populations, people who are coming home from nursing homes. Those patients have a lot of things wrong with them. They need more care and they're more expensive to treat. The impact of this policy is likely to be most severe in patients who have, in hospitals that have a lot of those patients. So hospitals that take a lot of nursing home patients and that are in low SES neighborhoods. Those hospitals already haven't got enough money. They don't have enough money to implement infection control policies. Possibly penalizing them even more is not going to make them spend more money on this. Do you see the problem? So there's like a population issue here. So some of the things that we're looking at is whether we can predict, we want to study this problem in our data. Remember I told you about propensity score matching? Our big problem is trying to get the infected cases matched properly to the non-infected cases so we don't match somebody who comes in and looks perfectly healthy with somebody who comes in with loads of risk factors and looks really sick. We're going to use this propensity score matching, trying to see whether we can identify cases. One of our ideas that nobody's ever done before is to see whether the costs incurred by the hospital prior to infection can be thought of as a risk factor, so that's just our own funky thing. Should I stop here? Let me stop here instead of talking about electronic medical records because that's going to be boring and take too long. But just to say, everything is harder than you think. Nothing is as accurate as you would like it to be. But there's a lot we can do. And there's the opportunity to design better policy by melding science and economics together to think more about how this process works and what the incentives of intervening in it might be. So let me stop there.